our closest neighbor still harbors new surprises and unsolved mysteries. You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Raymond Francis, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The Earth's moon is the most accessible celestial body, nearby with relatively low energy cost to reach, and so it remains the only one to have been visited by astronauts, and has been the target of robotic spacecraft from several nations over the past half century. Yet it remains very much unexplored. Even though its surface features are visible with the naked eye from our home on the Earth's surface, a great deal remains unknown about the moon's history, formation, geology, and mineralogy. Dry and airless, with no winds or water to erode its features, the moon records billions of years of its own history, and, through the countless impact craters that cover its surface, the record of changes in the solar system over that time. New craters overlie old, and the density of craters in an area can give a measure of the number of small craters that were flying around in the solar system at the time some of them struck the moon, and of the age of that terrain. They're also nature's drills, probing deep into the crust to expose lower layers not otherwise visible, and scattering the excavated materials nearby as ejecta, ready to be studied by orbiting cameras and spectrometers. Bhairavi Shankar, a recent PhD graduate from CPSX, studies these clues on the moon's surface. In her work, she uses data from robotic probes to carefully map the areas around key lunar craters, helping to piece together the history and better understand the nature of the Earth's nearest neighbor. Western World's Alyssa Gilbert spoke to Dr. Shankar about what we're still learning from lunar missions and what we still don't know.
Western Worlds, thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you recently finished your PhD here at Western, so I was wondering to start us out if you could tell us about what your research was about and what were the interesting findings that came out of it.
My research was to assess the distribution of impact melt deposits around impact craters. Specific focus was on assessing these distributions around large impact craters, typically ones that are more than about 75 kilometers, and my research site was on the moon. We use impact craters as a way to learn about a planetary subsurface. On Earth, the one good thing is with many rocks around, we can easily access them. We can go up to a rock and look at it closely and do lab analyses and figure out what it's made up of. But with other planets, such as the Moon or Mars or any of the other satellites, it's never quite easy to know what's beneath the top visible surface. And a lot of times impact craters are used as perfect tools to understand what the subsurface is made up of.
You mentioned that you use different data sets and stuff. Can you tell us a little bit about the satellites and instruments that you used in your thesis?
Yeah. Actually, this was a very interesting process. In the last about 20 years or so, various space agencies have sent up different satellites to essentially go and take global high-resolution imagery of the moon. NASA has been a sort of leader in that front. They have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is still functioning. And essentially, that orbiter has a diverse set of instruments, including cameras and great tool to assess the topography of the moon. With the satellite that's orbiting a few hundred kilometers above the planet moon's surface, we're able to resolve features that are the size of a small rock or even a boulder, which in the past has not been so easily observable. That was NASA had an LRO, which is their instrument suite. Similarly, Chandrayaan 1, which was sent out by the Indian-based agency, has essentially multispectral sensors. The instrument is able to send out a signal and essentially get back data in various wavelengths, which is, it has about 86 filters in that instrument. So essentially you're getting a signature that helps researchers understand the mineralogical compositions and detail in that aspect by looking at such high resolution data sets. And another set of high res data is from the Japanese agency. It's called Kaguya, and they have had a whole suite of instruments similar to what Chandrayaan has and also what LRO has, but it's essentially with all of these various instruments they have, they're covering a large spectral and spatial range that helps researchers get really high resolution detail about the moon. One of the interesting features by getting access to these data is to study about the lunar far side. That is one side that is not necessarily, it's not at all visible to us on Earth. So a lot of what we know about the lunar far side is solely dependent on all of these data. So my thesis was using a combination of LRO data and Chandrayaan 1 data to essentially look at the distribution of melt deposits around craters that were, I looked at three various craters. One was Schrodinger Basin. Typically, craters larger than 100 kilometers are called basins because their internal structure is not just a bowl-shaped depression. It is actually a bit more complex, much more complex in that it has a central uplift. And in the case of Schrodinger, that uplift is in the form of a peak ring. Another type of impact crater that I looked at was Alcott Crater, which is about 80 kilometers in diameter. It's much smaller than Schrodinger, but the interior of Alcott is with a cluster of peaks. And then the third crater was Kovalevskaya, which is in the central equatorial regions of the far side. The central uplift is one central peak, which is the most typically associated morphology for complex craters.
So you mentioned, you know, we have most of our knowledge of the far side, of course, from these types of satellite missions and stuff, because, of course, we can't see it. So is there a large difference between the near side and the far side? And so what are some of the differences there?
Yes, there is, and it's actually quite distinct. When we look at the moon each night, all we notice is these dark patches and brighter patches. Essentially, the dark patches are volcanic in nature. They're lava flows that have essentially filled up large impact basins. And the lighter stuff are what's known as the highlands. They're essentially original lunar crust that have over time been pummeled through with later impact events. So you're seeing on the near side a lot of different types of impact craters, with different size ranges, but also a large component of it is filled with these lava volcanic mare basalts, as they're known. On the lunar far side, however, it's very much different in that only about 1% of the total far side area is covered by these volcanic flows. So it's very contrasting. A lot of the area is essentially highland material, so much of it is the bright things that we see on the near side. The other interesting thing of the far side is that starting from the equator and extending much to the southern parts of that hemisphere is, if someone were to look at a 3D model of it or a 3D sphere of the moon focused on the far side, they'd notice a sort of slightly darker shade or tint of area, and that's what is known as the South Pole Aitken Basin. And that is it's a very significant feature on the moon. It's essentially a very large and very old impact basin. And the unique thing of this is that South Pole Aitken Basin is about 2,100 kilometers in diameter. It's not perfectly circular. It has a bit of an oval shape, but all again, now with more improved data sets that we're getting of the area. The size and the range, the shape of this basin is getting more and more clear. The most interesting thing of the South Pole Aitken Basin is that many researchers believe it's happened early enough in the moon's history that it has essentially since then recorded every major impact event that has happened on that side of the moon. The other thing that's interesting of the SPA Basin, as it's more commonly known, is that because it's so large, it is also quite deep. It's 2,100 kilometers in diameter and about 12 to 13 kilometers in depth. So essentially, when we're thinking about the makeup of the lunar crust, it extends far enough that potentially it may have tapped into the lunar mantle when it was excavating things during that impact event. However, that is still a question that's being addressed.
So it's really interesting that there's a kind of a lot of research going on the moon, because, you know, if you talk to the public, they kind of think, oh, it's the moon. We know all about it. We've been there, done that, and let's move on. So I assume you don't feel that way, right? You think that we should keep
indeed
doing research? I assume, like, what are the kind of main things that lunar researchers want to find out in the nearest future about the moon?
There are many things, actually. The first thing that comes to mind is what we've understood from the Apollo missions has, while it has been very much relevant and very much, it has given us a lot of information, the one thing is that the Apollo missions only cover a small surface area of the whole planet. Results from those have been used to further our understanding of the moon in general. So what we thought of as like ages for when major impact events have occurred, and just the surface ages of many parts of the moon have been in many ways dependent on what we've learned from Apollo. So one of the main reasons to go back is to actually see if, and select a new site on the moon totally that's away from Apollo, is to see if our theories or if our models and our hypotheses are actually true, or by, for example, going to the South Pole Aitken Basin, could we actually get an older age for the moon or many of those regions? So that would be the number one thing for going back. The other reason is if we are thinking about going to Mars, a lot of what we know about the human body and adaptability is right now in its infancy. So the moon is, again, a great place to go back and test new astronaut suits, or even just thresholds of how much the body can handle. The other thing is with communications, it's easy for us to land to the near side and have direct access to Earth and keep in constant contact with Earth. But if we were to land on the far side, while there's so much geology and so much scientific value in going to the far side, we still need to know if we can survive the whole lack of communication, lack of giving commands of what needs to get done to astronauts or even to a rover if we're sending that. So there are many, many things that still need to be addressed, and going to the moon is sort of the easy next spot that we could go and test beyond the International Space Station, where they're already doing a lot of these tests.
I mean, it's obviously much easier, or a much shorter time anyway, to get to the moon, right? It's about three days to get to the moon. So it makes sense to kind of do some testing there before we start sending people for 8 months or 3 year journeys or whatever it is to Mars.
With many of the recent data sets, such as from the Chandrayaan mission or even Kaguya, we're getting a lot of these multispectral data details. Essentially, satellites are recording things that help scientists with the various wavelength filters. We're able to assess the potential rock types that may be present on the moon that may be excavated by impact events. So essentially going back and landing at one of these sites where there's a lot of geological diversity may help us ground truth if there are those exact rock types and the potential of what that might mean about the crustal makeup of the moon. How far deep are we getting into the mantle? One of the most recent missions that I didn't have a chance to work with their data, but they've had really fantastic results, is from the GRAIL mission, where essentially they were these two instrument sensors were sort of piggyback riding each other and collecting gravity data and topography data. And to get us that detail in such high resolutions, essentially their results were suggesting that the crustal thickness is not as thick as we had originally estimated. Early on, even up until like last year or so, the thought was always the near side had about 40 to 50 kilometer thick crusts, and the far side had up to 90 kilometer thick crusts before you got into the mantle and stuff. But Grail is now suggesting you had maybe 30 to 40. Mm. So how does that help or affect our whole model approach or even thinking about how deep impact craters might excavate materials from? Are those different rock types that we're seeing part of the crust, or are they part of the mantle, or is it a combination of all of that? So definitely more and more reasons to go back and land there, because then we can actually pick up rocks and then do some analyses, either bringing it back to Earth or even doing it if the technology makes it possible to actually just test it right there as to see what these rock types are.
There were some results that came out, I think, about a year or so ago about potential water on the moon. And they crashed what was that mission?
That was LCROSS.
LCROSS. So they basically crashed a probe or whatever into a crater. They thought that they saw some evidence of water vapor or water ice.
So yes, LCROSS, I think in late 2010, they crashed their probe into a permanently shadowed area of the moon that's essentially close to the poles, areas that don't get sunlight practically ever. So they're really cold, and being craters, they're thought to pool in any sort of volatiles that may be present on the moon. They found evidence of hydroxyl and hydrogen. It's not in quantities that we're so used to seeing as on Earth, because we have oceans and whatnot, but it definitely helps address that the moon is not totally dry.
Right, so it's not like there was this big plume of water or something coming up, right?
No.
I think there were a few people that were hoping that was going to happen.
I think a lot of even the public have assumed that it's like a lot large pools of water that is just sitting there, but it's a bit more complex than that. They know that the individual components are there,
right?
If that could form water, if the conditions are right, sure, it might. But the interesting thing that they had found, which is still perplexing to scientists right now, and I think they're still trying to address it, is that they're able to see this migration of hydroxyl molecules and whatnot from the poles towards the equator. Mm. And all of that is dependent on, I think it's sun angle or something, but it's not, when the conditions are right, they see this migration happen towards the equators, but when it's not, it just kind of retreats back towards the poles. And they don't know yet if this is a daily occurrence, and I don't know if this is a daily occurrence or if it's just on a cyclic scale. But yeah, it's not a dry planet. It's definitely good if you're thinking of sending humans out to the moon. The excitement on this is that, okay, if eventually you need to send astronauts out there, you don't maybe need to send a whole lot of water or use up a lot of your space, in that you can maybe go out there and actually extract some of those volatiles and make it handy and useful for astronauts while they're there.
And one of the kind of running themes we see in planetary science research lately is that we think that all these planets besides Earth are dead, when really there are things going on them. And it seems to be getting more and more interesting.
Definitely. It's very dynamic.
There, yes. Yeah.
It's not just like it happened early on in history and then the planet has had a chance just to go, like impact cratering, which is such a common process throughout the solar system. Anytime there's a free floating space rock, chances are it may hit a planet if it gets close by to it. So the sort of domino effect of that is still there even to this day. So it's every planet has something it just needs more looking at.
Right.
Figure out.
Okay, well, I think that's probably all the time we have, so thanks so much.
Thank you for having
me. Good luck in your future endeavors. I'm sure we'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. let's go to the discussion.
So So we just listened to my interview with Paravi Shankar, who's a PhD, or sorry, who recently finished her PhD here at Western and is now actually a postdoc here. And she talked about her research that was done on the moon and lunar craters. And one of the things that I find typically comes up when discussing the moon with researchers as well as the public is a lot of people tend to think that, you know, it's our nearest neighbor, we've been there, done that, and we kind of know everything. It's just this big rock in the sky. But as we heard from the interview, there's actually a lot of things that we don't know about the moon and a lot of things that we still need to find out.
I think for me, the most interesting part about moon is that we don't know how it's formed. Like, there are theories on, you know, maybe something crashed into Earth when it was, like, really, you know, gooey and something that splashed off in the space forming Earth. And then there are other theories that it probably just came up from somewhere else, and I don't know. Like, there are tons of theories going around, but we exactly don't know how it formed. We don't know how it formed, actually, until we get, as B said, some few actual rocks from moon. I mean, Apollo has done that, but we need some from the far side and some from different locations, you know. Maybe a rock from the same location might have the same origin or formed at probably the same time. But if we have more data points all over the moon, we might be able to pinpoint on its formation, which is probably the most basic question, given that it's like the closest member in the solar system family.
That's right. You think that we would know more about it, but it's so hard. I mean, like you said, there's theories out there about a giant impact forming the moon as something Mars-sized crashed into Earth when it was still kind of a molten lava ball. But, I mean, that's kind of what us planetary scientists and astronomers like to use when we don't know how to explain something, right? It's, you know, we got a big, there must have been an explosion or some sort of collision. And the collision idea makes sense because of the Earth being tilted and stuff, but we don't really know what happened and how long it took and when it happened and all this stuff. So, yeah, getting samples from around the moon and, you know, getting a better idea, a better distribution of it, right, is going to help us. So it really gives us motivation to actually send people back there and rovers back there. You know, we did a lot of exploration in the 60s and early 70s, but we haven't really done much on the surface since.
It's also, we all know that the moon faces the Earth with one of its side of its surface, so. And also there's a huge difference in topology between the near side and far side, and as well as the thickness of its crust. Yeah, there's still a lot more to learn. Like, we don't know, do we know why one side is thicker than the other?
Well, I think some of the theories say that it's probably the impact, some kind of impact that happened. But again,
there's still a lot to learn about the moon. Uh-huh. And when people see the far side compared to the near side, it's a totally different.
Right, there are a lot of the large mare or sea regions, right, on the front of the moon, but on the back, it's very heavily cratered with much smaller craters. Yeah. So why is that? You know, and there's some theories out there that maybe the Earth acts like a magnet to bring in asteroids, but then they don't actually hit the Earth; they get focused onto the moon, but. You know, statistically speaking, the moon's so small compared with the orbit around the Earth that how often that happens, I don't know. I'm not a planetary dynamicist, but maybe we could ask someone about that. But yeah, it was quite interesting when she was talking about some of the reports that were made at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference back in March, that the crust, the thickness of the crust is quite different. Yeah. And why is that? Is it from impacts, or is it from stuff collecting there, or what's going on there?
Yeah, I also find the impact basin she talked about at the far side, which is pretty huge. I think the depth is around 10, 13 kilometers, she said, and that's huge. I mean, she said it kind of exposes the mantle. So if we really want to know what's in the moon... It's actually inside the moon, then that would be a good place for astronauts to go. And you know, it's kind of practicing going to Mars, given, as she said, it's on the other side. Communications is not always like you, you know, call your friend on the phone from here, the halfway around the world, because obviously there is a lot of lag time. And if we are planning to go to Mars, this is kind of the practice we need. And obviously with that practice comes a lot of data points and a lot of rocks that the astronauts could bring back. And we could probably understand what the mantle is made up of, because given what we were talking about, the giant impact hypothesis, that is how the moon formed, they actually kind of provide an idea what we should be able to find the moon, given that if that's the correct way it formed. So if we want to test the theory, that is the place we would find the evidence for. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really interesting area.
Yeah, there's all sorts of reasons for us to go back, I think.
Also, the topic of water, whether there's water near the poles of the moon.
Right.
Because yeah. You mentioned the LaCrosse mission.
Yeah,
LaCrosse, they crashed a copper probe into the northern or the southern?
It was the southern.
Southern pole. And yeah. They found signs of hydroxide.
You know, it's interesting because we tend to think the moon is this dead,
dry
planet. But now, you know, as we find out more and more, we find out that there's more stuff going on there and potentially
water.
Because there's
pretty incredible.
Well, there's people talking about mining asteroids, but you know, the moon is so much closer to our planet. Maybe we can mine the moon instead for whatever it's there.
Yeah, well, I think mining asteroids is more targeted toward things like iron and nickel and metals that. But, of course, you can get water or hydrogen and oxygen out of them as well to make our own water, which is one of the things that they're going after as well. But I do think in terms of, you know, if you think about human exploration, I really do think it is a good
first step
again, even though we took it 40 years ago, to go back to the moon. It's close. It's only 3 days away. You can communicate relatively easily, but you can still do lots of interesting things and lots of training, testing lots of, say, communications and other technologies there while it's relatively close by.
And I think also what I found interesting, I'm not sure if the place where LaCrosse actually hit was anywhere close to the basin, Acton Basin, what B was talking about. But if it's close, you never know what's in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that she talked about Chandrayaan, which actually has multi-spectral analysis, makes multi-spectral analysis possible, and I'm not sure if they've actually analyzed that area. But that would be pretty awesome to see if actually they have analyzed and if they found something. I mean, what's in the mantle? That's, I don't know. I find it interesting to know what would be in there.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. Western Worlds was created by John Moores. This episode was produced by Parshati Patel and Michael Forster, and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Parshati Patel, Alyssa Gilbert, and Zengyi Hu. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert and Parshati Patel, and I'm Raymond Francis. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website at cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can once again make world enough in time to join us next week, right here, on astronomy.fm.